This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
The story, if you believed my medical records, which you don't have to, but we should. Mm. I suddenly fell into a coma, and it was very mysterious. This was in my final year of graduate school at UC Berkeley, where I was writing my dissertation with Kaja, beginning the job search, which was much less horrible than I think it is now, as many of you know. And a friend happened to be coming to my apartment in Oakland for lunch, and she found me collapsed. Took me straight to the, I don't know why, but she took me to the Student Health Center, which is not what you should do. And they immediately, yeah, don't ever do that. You know, they give out condoms and birth control, which is great, but they're not prepared to deal with a, at that point, almost comatose person. Anyway, we got there, and the last thing, I had dinner with this friend recently, and she told me that the last thing I said before I was fully in the coma, I said when the firemen showed up. And as firemen are wont to be, they were beautiful, you know, strapping gentlemen. And I said, apparently, "Hello, boys, take me away." I have no memory of this, but that is apparently what happened. And they did take me away. And the next thing I knew, I was coming out of a series of hallucinations that were absolutely terrifying, that I was convinced was real. And there have been studies done recently about the hallucinations that people who have septicemia in the hospital have. They're specific to being in the hospital, specific to being in the ICU or critical care, actually. And they involve the architecture of the place changing. I mean, there's incredible overlap in these hallucinations, but in my case, the room, you know, you couldn't trust anything about the room. It would become a French boudoir. You know, in the late 19th century, it would become a sweeping seascape in Cape Cod or something. And it was horrifying. And when I came out of it, eventually and finally realized those were hallucinations, they are not real, I remembered all of these other things I had apparently begun to wake up into, including various eye surgeries, involving both needles and instruments, these weird invasive diagnostic things they do where they insert things into your throat and go down as deep as they can. Some of you are nodding, so you know what I'm talking about. I have no idea what they're called. I never want to know what they're called. And doing every form of imaging that the hospital knew how to do. So in short, they couldn't figure out what the problem was. They eventually discovered, can we go back to my two little friends? There they are. They eventually discovered that this was a MRSA infection that had invaded my bloodstream and every organ, and it was beginning to colonize my heart, but had otherwise colonized my kidneys, my liver, my pancreas, my bones, and so on. So I was in that hospital for about 2 months, and then they discharged me without having fully treated the infection. And so within a matter of weeks, I was back in the hospital where they realized, Aaron, if you could go back to the nuclear scan, the skeletons there. This is when they took these images and realized that, in fact, they had made a terrible mistake, and the bacteria had gotten deep into various bones, as you can see with around the knees and also my pelvis. And I was once again on the verge of death. At this point, they began a series of rapid-fire, every-other-day surgeries. This is when you came to... And I was on the psych ward at San Francisco General because they had no beds. No other hospital had any availability. Anyway, they did these horrific surgeries, one right after the other, attempting to clear out the infection, which they realized they actually could not do, and so they sent me to what is essentially a palatial resort, the UCSF hospital in the Parnassus campus by Golden Gate Park in San Francisco. I mean, I highly recommend it if you're ever, you know, in a situation where you are about to die, or so they think. I highly recommend UCSF, having, you know, eventually gotten there. But there they figured out a way to remove enough of the diseased tissue all over my body that they could get rid of the bulk of the bacterial infection. But of course, I continue to carry, as most of us do, some form of resistant staph on various parts of my body. The other most traumatic part of this, you know, aside from all that, was the retinal surgeries, which continued long after I was finally released from the hospital, and which have been probably the most profound epistemological change in the way that I am in the world. So
let's talk about that. You're making my job really easy.
Do some work here, Kasia. Well, I mean, as you know, I was a visual person. I had always been someone who derived uncomplicated pleasure from seeing and from looking, and from approaching and occupying what I had never questioned or thought of in complicated ways as a visual field. For me,
like the strapping fireman.
Take me away, boys. You know, that was the last gasp of such simple visuality. For me, blindness and visuality were in opposition, and blindness was the terrifying hell of absence, and visuality was the uncomplicated, simple world of just being a person. And, you know, through the experience of, first of all, having a wonderful retinal surgeon to whom I gestured in the opening section of that, but also finding ways through Kasia's work and through the work of a handful of other people in the UC system in California who don't take simple visuality as an uncomplicated surface on which we all move. I, as my retinal specialist, who's fully sighted, has never had a procedure on his eyes, doesn't even wear contact lenses or glasses, better than 20/20 vision,
amazing,
and beautiful eyes, I should say. But that's a whole other part of the story.
That's the beautiful eyes part of the story.
That's one of the beautiful eyes part of the story. But he once said to me, when we were having one of our many complicated conversations about eyes, immediately after one of the surgeries, when he had to sit with me to keep me calm, he said, it's you who now see. You have, by virtue of not only what these experiences have been, but also through the visual world that you now occupy, you have a more rigorous sense of what vision is and what the visual world is than any of us, meaning those with normate vision who are have had uncomplicated or untroubled visual pasts, will ever know. And he told me, as I was telling you this morning, I think, or last night, this incredible story about what happens when you have, you know, what are popularly called blind spots, but what clinically are called blank spots, where the visual parts of the brain have to fill areas on the skin, the sort of movie screen of the retina that have been damaged. They have to fill that space with other data that the brain has collected. And so if you are looking at a relatively even field, like a white wall, for example, it, you know, looking at it now, it looks as if I have no breaks in a fairly normative visual field. because the brain simply takes the data from around the blank spots and fills the space, making it a whole field. Things become more complicated in the social world. As I look at you, for example, my brain, as if it's an independent thing, but you know, doesn't know how to fill the gaps that my retinas hold when I look at you. So when I was first becoming accustomed to this, I would see, you know, walking down the street in Oakland, out of the blue, I would see my grandmother walking. You know, my grandmother was not there. My grandmother was long gone. I mean, there's no reason my grandmother would suddenly pop up, except as this retinal surgeon explained to me, vision is deeply psychic, he said. It's profoundly psychic, and the brain is not just a data set. It's not a computer the way that people sort of allegorize it. The brain is actually a deeply sensate and feeling thing, and it fills the visual field and makes sense of the visual field in ways that are intimate to you and to what you're feeling in a particular moment. Yeah. I had never had an opportunity to think about that, and it's stunning.
It's stunning.
And it makes looking at things where you're not actively thinking about complicating what you see or doubting what you see, it makes that process more interesting and more real.
Didn't you tell me that he brought up Freud?
He brought up Freud. I mean, I think he actually said at one point, you know, the skin is the outgrowth of the psyche. I mean, I think that sentence actually came out of his mouth. But yeah, he
very exceptional. Very exceptional.
If I should say, don't take this as an example for what you'll find if you ever find yourself in this situation. I had some wonderful, not so much surgeons, but some wonderful doctors. The nurses were almost universally wonderful. Physicians, that uniformity of wonderfulness was not there, shall we say. But I had some wonderful people, including him.
Yeah. So you were talking to me last night about how you've made your peace. So how has it been for you in the time, visually speaking, in the intervening time?
So these are my retinas, and this has not changed since the active infection. So if you look, okay, let me do some tracing of retinal geography here. All right, so if you look in this, can everyone see where I'm pointing? So the furthest on the left, second row from the bottom. Well, that's going to be hard because there's so much damage. So far on the right, second from the top. Do you see the one I'm pointing to now? Okay. So all of the places where the veins are sort of coming together, this is where the optic nerve enters the retina, right? So this is where information is taken from the retina to the brain. To the right of that confluence of nerves is a sort of, I'm not talking about the big spot in the middle, but the darker shade of a spot that looks almost like a shadow on the ground below that cloud-looking thing, that's the macula. And the macula is the part of the retina that is your central vision. It is, in other words, the domain of the conscious, right? And if we want to think it in geographic psychic terms. So that is where central vision is produced. The white scars you see everywhere are scar tissue on the retina itself from the active MRSA infection. And so the retinal tissue has been leached of its ability to gather information. And in addition to the sort of retinal skein being damaged and destroyed, underneath the retina, well, behind the retina in your eye, are light receptor cells. Those all die when this kind of damage happens. So this is all permanent damage, and all of it creates an imbalance in the eye.
I think that your capacity to talk about that was overwhelmingly impressive. I mean, that was just stunning, both as a demonstration of scientific knowledge and and the way you have accommodated it psychically, it's amazing.
Well, it's not, it's not all, you know, like any relationship, it's not always a happy union. there are moments, there are long moments where I'm ashamed to say this because I want to value everything I can about my current being in the world.
Right.
But there are moments of profound mourning.
How could there not be?
How could there not be when such dramatic change has happened? I've tried to experience it as something more than just loss. But loss is still there. And that's what slams into me like the moon shadow of the eclipse.
Yeah. But in a weird kind of way, if you could put everything in reverse, there would be loss at that end, too.
Correct. That's what I'm continuing to learn.
Yeah.
I can give you one one way that I've strategically, I mean, this is an almost too pithy an example and silly an example, but it's very real. One way that this has been an additive experience, or a positive change, I guess, colloquially, and that is in faculty meetings. When I told you this last night, when someone is, someone I could do without, I simply place my eyes in a particular direction, and they no longer exist. It's immediate, they're gone. And if I can focus my sonic receptors on something else, then they are completely obliterated from my...
Well, I always love this word scotomization from Freud, which was that kind of developing a blind spot conveniently at moment, yes.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, so this is obviously a long and philosophically rich conversation that could go on for a long time. Let's talk a bit about the bacteria part of it. How, so you went and learned. I mean, you took this experience, this an invitation to learn an enormous amount. I mean, it's staggering, really. So tell us about bacteria. Tell us the bacteria story in general, and then in particular.
Well, in general, the field of microbiology is fascinating. There was a Dutch, some of you may know of Van Leeuwenhoek, who was a Dutch draper and farmer in the 16th century, who started building early versions of microscopes to look at things, very crude versions of microscopes. And he began noticing what he called animalcula or something in liquid. Mm-hmm. He would see little things swimming around, and he started to think of them as little animals. That was his understanding of what they were. And so this provincial Dutch draper and farmer began writing letters to the Royal Society, who dismissed this as bizarre, you know, some crank from from the woods who has no idea what he's talking about. And because he had built these early models of a microscope that were capable of seeing microbes, the Royal Society in London was not yet able to replicate those machines. And so it was only retroactively, long after his death, that he was actually sort of acknowledged for having done this thing. You know, there are letters that you can find in archives where he's writing about looking at rainwater that has fallen directly from the clouds. And that is what convinced him that these were not invaders of the water from somewhere else. It was actually a part of the world that was falling down on him. You know, and things sort of took off from after his death into the development of germ theory and people learning about the different classes of this species, of this set of species, and then slowly understanding both the relationship between microbes and disease, and we're finding it, you know, ways to eradicate this class of being. You know, the story that you've probably heard about penicillin is not actually you know, the sort of full true story. I write about this a bit. There was a woman, you know, the person who discovered penicillin was really a woman.
Yeah.
An assistant who went out and just bought fruit everywhere to try to replicate the growth of this strange fuzz. No, it's an unknown person. She gets jokingly called Moldy Mary, right? Because she finally, on a cantaloupe skin, grew the penicillin that worked to eradicate staph, or some version of, I can't remember, some related version of bacteria. But as soon as that development happened, the bacteria were smart enough to develop resistances. So they have these chemical brains that understand threat and immediately produce the sort of keys to unlock the logic of that threat.
Yeah.
So the M in methicillin that constitutes the name MRSA, it's a misnomer. I mean, methicillin never really worked. As soon as it was, it's an artificial version of penicillin, and as soon as it was produced, all staph was MRSA, you know, back in the 60s and 70s. So it's strange that this name has sort of stuck with this class of staph that are increasingly smart. When I was in the hospital, there was only one antibiotic left that worked on MRSA. It was vancomycin. And in recent years, there is now vancomycin-resistant MRSA.
So and no other?
There is a recent antibiotic that I don't know a lot about, but there's no money in antibiotic research and production, so of course the drug companies aren't spending a lot of time on making antibiotics.
Right. So then the philosophical story of the bacteria, and then I think we'll go to Q&A.
Okay. The philosophical, do you mean the love?
I mean the love.
we'll call that philosophical. I'm not sure how my awareness of that relationship developed, but I know that I... at some point, you know, occasionally you get a sort of outbreak where, as I write in the book, a renegade few will break out and try to make a run for it, essentially. And this, you know, creates a minor infection generally on your skin that's treatable and goes away. But I think it was during one of the repetitions of the rituals you have to go through when you are dealing with a moment like that and you have this history, I was also going through a breakup of a very serious relationship. And I felt overwhelmed by the rituals moment by moment, hour by hour, day by day that it took to structure a relationship, just to keep a relationship going. And as I was ending this particular long-term relationship, I was feeling this sort of freedom from the ritual that soon became emptiness. It soon became loss, another kind of loss.
Right.
And that, the fact that that was sort of coterminous with having this minor outbreak, the rituals of cleansing and washing and putting the salve on and all that felt like relationship maintenance, you know? It felt like what you do when you're in love. You get the stain out, you clean up the dishes, you know? You replace the toilet paper, whatever it is you have to do. And that, I haven't told that story before, but that's, I think that's a moment where I started to think about this as a relation, a sort of, maybe not symbiotic, but a relationship where things actually matter to both of us.
Yeah.
I had long ago looked at those images and thought, they are so beautiful. I don't care that they're my, I mean, I don't care what they tell me about my own trauma. Mm. I find them, especially the black and white ones. Can we go back to those for a moment, Aaron? The array of black and white. I mean, I just find them, a few more back. I find them so stunningly beautiful, like this. And you know, the bacteria made them. And there was no space in the hospital or in most clinical places to think about that, to think about the fact that I respected the aesthetic eye of these bacteria. You know, I think it's stunning. So I'm not sure if that's a proper answer to your question.
They should feel honored to be in your body.
They should feel honored to be in my body. I don't know if they do, but they should.
So my last question is a very tiny one. It has to do with the word achingly in the first passage you read to us. I find that just an overwhelming word in that context. So maybe you can restate I can practically say it myself. I've repeated
and
it so many
it's
times.
It's something like, and achingly we grew stronger.
And achingly, right, he fought us with all he had, and achingly we grew stronger.
The love came later. So you're asking, what is that word?
Why that word? I mean, it does so much affective work.
To me, the word aching is a word that is born out of the repetition of a labor of love, the repetition of some kind of physical exertion that is about something about which you are obsessed or on which you are completely focused. Yeah. You know, I don't even know if you know this about me, but I was a competitive gymnast for a long time growing up.
I think I do
up.
Know that
okay.
about you.
And I associate that word with, the pain of the repetition of the routines that defined nightly workouts, nightly practice, and so on. And that was my world. It was a labor of love. And so at that point in that description, I'm suggesting that these bacteria have already developed a relationship that is moving towards love.
Yeah,
and for them, it is the ache that gestures in that direction.
Yeah.
It's the throb of repetition in the hope that something will be different the next time or the time after that.
Yeah.